the afternoon, but probably no significant covering of snow. Highs of 6 in Cardiff, 5 in Birmingham and London, but feeling a lot colder. And the outlook for Wednesday, further strong winds, very cold, wintry showers in eastern Scotland and also England, but sunny in western parts of the British Isles. Back to you, David.
Thank you, Thomas. You bring good cheer as ever. And now our book of the week is Paul Kildare's new biography of Benjamin Britten, published in the composer's centenary year. Alex Jennings reads the first of 5 abridged extracts from Benjamin Britten, A Life in the 20th Century.
With as much pomp and ritual as he could muster, in July 1951, the mayor of Lowestoft stood on stage at the Sparrow's Nest Theatre and granted honorary freedom of the borough to the town's most famous son, Benjamin Britten, who was born in Lowestoft 37 years earlier. It was not Britten's first time in the Sparrow's Nest. He recalled his earlier appearance.
Some of you may remember, more than 30 years ago, a very small boy, dressed in skin-coloured tights, with madly curly hair, trying desperately to remember the lines spoken by Tom the Water Baby, sitting on the lap of Mrs. Do As You Would Be Done By, played on this occasion by his own mother, on this very stage.
Postcards and photographs of Lowestoft at the time Britten was a boy show wide boardwalks and a bustling seafront, military bands on the Grand South Pier, busy streets with tram lines past impressive Victorian facades. There are terraces overlooking the sea, minutes away from the large house, 21 Kirkley Cliff Road, where the Britten family lived. Robert and Edith Britten moved into their seafront house in 1908. The youngest of their 4 children was christened Edward Benjamin soon after his birth on the 22nd of November, 1913. Robert worked hard in his dental practice, situated on the ground floor of the family home. Upstairs he referred to as heaven, a view the whole family shared. His hours were long and his habits, drinking aside, ascetic. Edith was very much softer and gentler, protective of her youngest, slightly delicate child. She was an amateur musician, active in the Lowestoft Musical Society, who had an extremely close bond with her son, encouraging his evident musical talent, seeking outside help when it developed beyond her. Edith allowed her son to think of himself as a composer from a young age, where someone less perceptive might have missed the signs. She assembled a team of musicians, Miss Ethel Assel for piano, sight reading and theory, Mrs. Audrey Alston for viola lessons, Harold Samuel for piano, and later Frank Bridge for composition. It is a glorious list, and even if some of it came about through happenstance, geographical and filial, it is no less impressive for that. Britten was comfortable on stage at an early age, an irony given his nervousness before performances later in life. Miss Ethel programmed small concerts, while at the musical soirees she hosted at home, Edith sang and young Benny played. Throughout their childhoods, all 4 Britten children were involved in theatrical productions of increasing ambition and sophistication. A pole was rigged up in the nursery, from which hung an improvised stage curtain. Nanny Walker prepared the scripts and the costumes. There was a touch of J.M. Barrie to the household, the rocking horse and cod liver oil, the smocks and sailor suits, cooks stoning raisins or baking fudge, the domestic music making, in lieu of the gramophone Mr. Britten refused to purchase, lest it discourage his children's musical talents. Britten later plundered his childhood memories for his composition. Though set in a house far grander than that on Kirkley Cliff Road, Britten's opera for children, The Little Sweep, is a sharp snapshot of his boyhood. Everything takes place in a well-appointed nursery. The score specifies, there is a toy cupboard at one side of the fireplace, an armchair, and a rocking horse. The year is 1810, yet the middle-class children who plot to save the sweet boy Sammy from his indenture and the nursemaid who aids them are straight from Britten's childhood.
Sweet
South Lodge, a small prep school of only 30 students. Britain proved a bright boy with an aptitude for mathematics, and soon came to the attention of the headmaster, a passionate mathematician and Greek scholar. The headmaster also had a taste for corporal punishment, which he inflicted with little provocation and which shocked young Britain. I can remember the first time that I heard a boy being beaten, and I can remember my absolute astonishment that people didn't immediately rush to help him. Britain was, on the whole, spared the experience, yet it is hardly fanciful to attribute his burgeoning aversion to cruelty and violence to what he witnessed here. Because he was a day boy, there were no letters home, and we know almost nothing about the books he read or what ideas were discussed. From a personal library of study scores he started in 1925, we know the large-scale music he was devouring. Beethoven symphonies, Stravinsky's The Firebird, Wagner overtures and preludes. By the time he went to public school in September 1928, he had accumulated a library of 64 scores. Since he had almost no opportunity to listen to these works, either on gramophone or in concert, it is evident he heard them perfectly well in his head. I have always found reading music easier than reading books, he said in 1962. He was like a synesthete who involuntarily sees colours when listening to sounds, except he happily heard music when looking at scores. It is a particular talent, by no means common to all composers. William Walton begrudgingly admired the skill. I do envy Ben Britten his being able to do it all in his head, like Mozart or Rossini. On his 9th birthday, Britten received Stainer and Barrett's A Dictionary of Musical Terms. He devoured it as though it were a detective novel, and his scores were instantly more prescriptive. In 1923, he revised his setting of Longfellow's Beware, adding a tempo marking, Allegro ma non troppo, Stainer and Barrett's work well applied. He later recalled, As a child, I heard little music outside my own home. The main event was the Norwich Triennial Festival. There, in 1924, when I was 10, I heard Frank Bridge conduct his suite, The Sea, and was knocked sideways. In 1927, I was taken to meet him. We got on splendidly, and I spent the next morning with him going over some of my music. From that moment, I used to go regularly to him, staying with him in Eastbourne or in London. Frank Bridge and his music are largely forgotten today, yet here was a fortuitous meeting of minds. A left-leaning pacifist and consummate craftsman, performer and conductor, Bridge was a living, walking, performing example of what a British composer could be. Exactly what Bridge must have made of the boy with his suitcase bulging with manuscripts can only be imagined. But one thing is certain. Bridge knew he should take Britten seriously. With introductions completed, the adolescent composer embarked a few months later on a remarkable course of study with the older musician. The lessons with Bridge were frequent and arduous. I remember one that started at 10:30, Britten later wrote, and at tea time Mrs. Bridge came in and said, Really, you must give the boy a break. There were tears from exhaustion and relatively little laughter. Composing was a serious business, not an amateur pastime. A composer must find himself, his voice, and be true to what he finds, taught Bridge. Bridge had been a force in his life for 9 months or so by the time Britten arrived at Gresham's school. With such a mentor, it is understandable that Britten's response to the Gresham's music master, Greatorex, was uncharitable. He described the man and his playing variously as awful, lacking in sanity, abominable. The poet, W. H. Auden, who was at the school from 1920 to 25, was more generous. I owe Greatorex not only such knowledge of music as I possess, but my first friendship with a grown-up person, with all that that means. Greatorex was also probably homosexual, though this would have made little impression on Britten. Unlike the sexually precocious, if prim, Auden, Britten's time at Gresham's coincided with only a dim awareness of his emerging sexuality. In 1930, he wrote three character pieces for piano. In the space of 2 years, Britain had transformed himself from a cosseted, precious boy with hazy notions of his voice as a composer and future as a pianist into an adolescent of startling achievement. That summer, he was awarded an open scholarship to the Royal College of Music. He arrived in London, aged just 16. His boarding house was in a cluttered row of terraces, not far from the Bridges Place in Kensington, with 5 or 6 floors occupied by tenants straight from an Agatha Christie mystery. Numerous old ladies, 2 foreign men, a woman called Tumpty and her callous sister. His room was small, nestled into the eaves, into which he squeezed an upright piano, taking care not to play after 10 at night. This was the time in his life in which he did the most work on his playing. Anyone who has had to rely on a technique refined in student days, but tended only occasionally thereafter, remains grateful for the initial investment. So it was with Britain. Peter Piers put it well when he said that Britain had an extraordinary perception between his brain and his heart and the tips of his fingers. You could watch Ben holding his hands over the piano, preparatory to playing a slow movement, a soft, soft chord, and you could see his fingers, alert, alive, really sometimes even quivering with intensity. It was amazing what colours he could get. For all his accomplishment, Britain could not have graduated at a worse time. The Depression left unemployment high, and the music industry had its own unique problems. Talkies arrived late the previous decade, and cinema orchestras collapsed in their wake. He needed a job, and in 1935 he began work for the GPO Film Unit. Composing for film requires specific skills, none of which Britain had ever thought about before, let alone acquired. He worked on the documentary film The King's Stamp, and Coalface with Auden. Auden was 28, the author of 4 books, cheerleader to a generation of brilliant writers, his reputation already considerable.
This is the night mill crossing the border, bringing the cheque and the postal order. Letters for the rich, letters for the poor, the shop of the corner and the girl next door.
Britain and Auden hit their stride with Night Mail, which remains an iconic work of art from the time. An attempt to illustrate how invisible workers grease the cogs of industrialised middle-class Britain, real people speak dialogue either written for or coaxed from them. In the film's final sequence, the lyric sounds as though it took Auden no more than a few hours one wet Sunday afternoon, and Britain's music leaves no greater impression. But together, they evoke the machine world and grand narrative scope of the mail train. The ending is full of semitone clashes and breathless woodwind flourishes, punctuated with trumpet fanfares that, incongruously, invoke an old-fashioned post horn. From the beginning of the 1930s, Auden had been using a whole bag of tricks, pastiche, parody, wordplay, to entertain, pay homage, and educate. Observing this in one of England's most brilliant young artists, Britain relaxed, dipped into this bag, and learn how to do the same in his music.
At the same time tomorrow, Alex Jennings continues reading from Benjamin Britten, A Life in the 20th Century by Paul Kildare. The abridger was Richard Hamilton and the producer was Elizabeth Allard. Well, the shipping forecast is just moments away, and to take us there, we go sailing by. And now the shipping forecast issued by the Met Office on behalf of the Maritime and Coast Guard Agency at 0015 today, Tuesday the 5th of February. There are warnings of gales in all areas except Trafalgar. The general synopsis at 1800, low North Faroes 963, expected North Tyne 981 by 1800 today. The area forecasts for the next 24 hours. Viking north at Sarah. Westerly 6 to gale 8, becoming variable 4, then becoming northerly 6 to gale 8 later. Squally wintry showers, moderate or poor, occasionally good. South at Sarah, westerly 6 to gale 8, veering northwesterly 4 or 5. Squally wintry showers, moderate or poor, occasionally good. 40s Cromartie 4th Tyne Dogger. West 7 to severe gale 9, becoming